This is study number 9 in our Australian camp meeting in the year 2001. So in our last study, we ended with reading some paragraphs from the chapter, Who is the Greatest in Desire of Ages. We had to read from our own books. Now we can read on the screen again, or from your own books, whatever is easier for you. It says there that Jesus, on the journey through Galilee, tried to prepare the mind of his disciples for the coming trials. Was it the first time? I'm not sure. Maybe it was not the first time that he talked about the coming sufferings and the crucifixion. And this was very unwelcome news for the disciple. So unwelcome that they would not really take it serious. In other words, they listened nominally. Yes, they understood every word, but their mind was somewhere else altogether. That happens sometimes, that our mind is somewhere altogether. And it especially happens then when we don't take the message serious enough. If you really take it serious, you must not miss one word, obviously, when our heart is really with a thing. Their heart was not in this matter. But where was their heart? Who is the greatest? That was their question. And they tried to conceal it from Jesus. Here I've underlined a few words, if you see. They disputed among themselves which should be accounted greatest in the kingdom. This strife they thought to conceal from Jesus, and they did not, as usual, press close to his side, but loitered behind. And yesterday we made the point that it is very sad that this time they should loiter behind. Normally they press close beside him. Normally they ask him every question. They told him everything, the good things and the bad things. But this time they tried to conceal something. And whenever we have learned, whenever children try to conceal something, that is suspicious. Why do they conceal? Because they have a bad conscience, obviously. When the door to the children's room closes very quietly, not normally bang, but very quietly, well then there must be something wrong. They loitered behind. And Jesus, we will learn this still, he was really encouraging his disciples to open up. He was really saying, well, tell me your problems. Tell me your situations. Even if you struggled about the question, who is the greatest? What did you talk about? He knew what they talked about. But he wanted to encourage them to tell him everything, to tell him all things. And that is our greatest problem to Jesus and to one another, that we tell him not all things. We tell him a few things, but not all things, because we are too ashamed to tell all things. But once we would be able to talk about it, then we could have help. That would be a great thing. Therefore, every wise father, every wise minister, or every wise elder, or every wise teacher, he will encourage the students to ask questions, won't he? Even if these questions a little bit silly at times, because the student knows so much, the teacher knows so much more than the students, and their questions, I mean, they bespeak of their ignorance, and yet he encourages this then. Please ask your questions. And nobody has to laugh if somebody asks a question in class, okay? Nobody has to laugh, because the teacher wants to encourage the students, he wants to create an atmosphere in which every question can be asked, provided it's an honest question, of course. So there's another situation where the disciples... Oh, wait a moment. Before we come to this, let's quickly turn to the text in... Where was it again? Luke? In Mark? Mark, chapter 9, verse 33. After they loitered behind and did not want to tell him at home, he asked them, what was it that you disputed among yourselves? And they kept silent. Now, I really imagine a wall here. And what is the name? What are the letters written on that wall? Silence. Silence can be a wall. I've experienced this not too long ago. I knew there were some difficulties and some difficulties of feelings as well. And I wanted to encourage the people to really speak. I said, do you have any question? No. Well, do you want to know what is in my mind? No. Can you tell me what is in your mind? absolute silence. I felt so helpless. In the end, I told the people, come, let's go for a walk. And then I saw that they really took effort to do something. They kept close beside, they didn't loiter behind, but they kept close beside me. And a better state of feelings came into existence. You see, at that stage, I could have given up and said, well, they don't want me, so... But I had to go on. And Jesus went on. He waited for the moment when they finally would speak. And the opportunity came. After a while, Peter came back, and the other disciples talked it over with him, and then one ventured to ask Jesus, Lord, who is the greatest? That took a lot of braveness to ask this question even. But the fact that they asked it, Jesus did not condemn. He answered it in a wise and good way. And so likewise, we want to create an atmosphere in the church and in the family in which everybody knows that he can ask his question. That is very important. On the other hand, of course, we know that Satan will misuse this freedom. And we had situations in a church, for example, where people ask questions in order to give sermons. How does this happen? In other words, their questions become so long, they put a question mark in the end, surely, in order to label it as a question, but it's more, they want to say something with it. I mean, I give you an example. Isn't the church apostate? Or could it be that the leaders of the church make mistakes? You know, when you know that there's a certain mind behind it, a certain thought, and such questions come, then you know, well, what does he want to lead us to? He wants to lead us to doubt and to question. Or like Lucifer, should God really have said, you shall not eat of every tree in the garden? Has God really said this? Or as he came to Jesus, are you really the Son of God? I mean, that are questions that are asked for the sake of putting the other mind into doubt. These kind of questions Jesus did not welcome, you can be sure of that. But the Pharisees constantly tried to pester him with that kind of question. And Jesus knew how to answer them. But if there's an honest question, if you have an honest heart and really want to know the answer, there should be always the atmosphere in the church, in the family, and wherever we are, you can ask your questions. Honest questions are always welcome, whenever they are asked. So, that is why the disciples finally asked this question, who is the greatest? Otherwise, they would never have come forth. Let me turn to another statement with you. You know, in the upper chamber, when Jesus was again talking about his sufferings, again the disciples did not listen, and again, what was the subject of their minds this time? They did not talk about it, but it was on their minds. Why would they not listen? Because of the same question, who is the greatest? They put an estimate upon one another. Judas thought, well, Matthew, he is too particular, he's too exact with everything. John, he's too soft. Peter, he's too impulsive. And so he put one estimate upon another on the disciples and said, if it was not for me, then the band of disciples would soon perish. The cause of Jesus would soon perish. It's good that they have me. So I must carry forward with my plans that I've carried out so far. And the other disciples, they had similar thoughts. Maybe their mind was not as wicked as that of Judas. They would never betray Jesus. But at the same time, they also had in their minds, who is the greatest? And so Jesus asked himself, how can I help them? And there was this occasion of the fact that somebody needed to wash the feet and there was nobody. And then what was their attitude in that matter? How does Sister White describe it? They kept silent again. There was again this silence. And she gives to this silence an interesting name. Let us turn now to Desire of Ages, to the chapter A Servant of Servants, chapter 71. Here it says, there was strife among them, which of them should be accounted the greatest, page 643, and now I come to page 644, the first paragraph. When the disciples entered the supper room, their hearts were full of resentful feelings. Judas pressed next to Christ on the left side. John was on the right. If there was a highest place, Judas was determined to have it. And that place was thought to be next to Christ, and Judas was a traitor. Another cause of dissension had arisen. At a feast, it was customary for a servant to wash the feet of the guests. And on this occasion, preparation had been made for the service. The pitcher, the basin, the towel were there in readiness for the feet washing, but no servant was present, and it was the disciples' part to perform it. But each of the disciples, yielding to wounded pride, determined not to act the part of a servant. All manifested a stoical unconcern, seeming unconscious that there was anything for them to do. By their silence, they refused to humble themselves. We can read this a little bit different. We can read it, by their silence, they built strong walls among each other. And now, how could Jesus break that walls? That was on the mind of Jesus. How can I break these walls? He was very unhappy about it. You can imagine, because in that condition, to send the disciples into this battle of Gethsemane was hopeless. How could he think that there would be any good results? How could he leave his disciples alone? He was about to leave them. It must have been a very stressful situation for Christ, as you can imagine. Multiple problems, I call this. And you know, Satan is very clever in this. He always gives us multiple problems, not only one, but many at a time, in order to really bring us down. You have experienced this too, haven't you? As I related to you the other night, how not only this one event took place, and another event took place, and another event still, and all at once, to crush us down if possible. But Jesus is in control. And so, the whole situation Jesus took for an advantage. It revealed something. You know, when such a thing is happening like this, we should not give up, because it is very often the storm before the victory. You know, sometimes a situation looks very dark and very cruel, and you seem to see no way out, but that these things come out is good. They are there anyway. That's the point. They have been there all the time, but we haven't seen them. It's like a latent disease that is there, and now, finally, it shows symptoms. And when it shows symptoms, the physician begins to work. Before it shows symptoms, what can you do? It's there, but you can't do anything. So, in that sense, it was good that the situation was there, that nobody stood up and served. Let's suppose somebody would have stood up as, as a form, but not in his heart, would have washed the disciples' feet. That would have been more embarrassing, wouldn't it? But the fact that they all showed this stoical unconcern gave Jesus an opportunity to do something. Now he could stand up. At least they were honest, you say. Well, okay. They couldn't help but be honest. You know, sin reveals itself one way or the other. And we can't help but doing what we are in the end. We do what we are. And so they manifested this stoical unconcern. Now, what does that word mean? They manifested a stoical unconcern. What does stoical mean? Yes. Doesn't involve me. I'm not part of it. Silence is the wall here. The big wall. Well, let's turn to... Let's turn to Acts chapter 17, verse 18. That is when Paul was in Athens, and there he met some Greek philosophers. That is a very interesting story, by the way. Let's begin in verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him when he saw the city was given over to idols. Therefore, he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Gentile worshippers, and in the marketplace daily with those who happened to be there. Then certain Epicurean and Stoic unconcern, you remember? Stoic philosophers encountered him, and some said, "What does this babbler want to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a proclaimer for foreign gods, because he preached to them Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine is of which you speak?" By the way, the word Areopagus is Greek, and in Roman it means Mars Hill, or in our language it's Mars Hill. And Mars was the god of war. A special holy place was this Areopagus. It was a hill just opposite to the temple precinct, from where you could see the temple, the Greek temple, and there were all the gods which Paul saw. And when he pointed to their idol worship and to this one unknown god which is there, he just had to point from the place where he was over to, and everybody saw it. You know, he said, "Here, that is the unknown god." Evidently, he spoke on the marketplace first with them, and that was very usual to discuss. The Athenians, they loved discussions. You know, you could discuss with them all the time about philosophy. And so Paul took advantage of this. He stood in the marketplace, but because it was so busy there, they led him on this consecrated place in order to really concentrate on what he had to say. It was a wonderful opportunity. And then Paul talked to them, and the people whom he met are called Epicurean and Stoics. Now, what do these people believe, or what did these people believe? Exactly. Epicureans were satisfying the pleasures. That's their main point. However, not to the extent where they would harm themselves. In other words, enjoy life, but don't enjoy it too much, so that you don't shorten your life. That is their philosophy. In other words, drink wine, but not too much, a little bit. And sin, but not too much, but a little bit only. You know, that's the idea. That was their philosophy. And today, when you look in the world today, I mean, the professed Christian world, they're all Epicureans, really.
Moderation.
Moderation is the idea of Epicurean philosophy. Now, what is the Stoic philosophy? The Stoics, as the word stoical unconcern says, they were showing unconcern. Now, in what way? They believed that you must not show feelings. You must absolutely stand above your feelings. In other words, when somebody dies of your family, you know, you don't weep. When you marry somebody, you don't rejoice. You're always equal. That's the idea. And so wanting to overcome their own passions and their own impulses, they took this position, this attitude, but they didn't take it just for themselves, they took it also for others. In other words, the same unconcern they showed for their own feelings, they showed also for others. So if somebody would suffer, they would say, "We are unconcerned." We have not. They would maybe tell him, "Well, you have to be a Stoic in order to overcome this." They probably wouldn't take painkillers if they would live today, because they would say, "Well, we live above these things." But in the end, they became hypocrites. I want to read to you a statement which I copied from Indifference, which I copied from a book. It's from the Bible Commentary, and it tells us a little bit about the philosophy. And this gives us an idea what stoical unconcern is. Stoics. This school of philosophy took its name not from its founder, Zeno, who lived 340 to 260 before Christ, of Citium in Cyprus, but from the Stoa Poikile, the painted porch in the Agora at Athens. Agora means marketplace. So there was a painted porch in the marketplace in Athens. That is where Zeno used to teach. So Josephus states that there are points of similarity between the Stoics and the Pharisees. And that's interesting. What is the idea of Phariseeism? it's being better than everybody else, isn't it? That is the basic idea of Phariseeism. It's a very high moral standard which you impose upon yourself and others, but you don't keep it. That is Phariseeism. And the Stoics were the Pharisees of the Gentiles. In other words, that what the Pharisees were in the Jewish society, that the Stoics were in the Hellenistic society. Indeed, it may be said that the attitude toward the moral life of heathenism at that time presented many features similar to that of the Pharisees. They taught that true wisdom consists in being the master and not the slave of circumstances. The things that are not in our power are neither to be coveted nor avoided, but are to be accepted with equanimity. That almost sounds like Sabbath rest, doesn't it? But it's a clever counterfeit. It's not Sabbath rest, really. The things that are not in our power are neither to be coveted nor avoided, but are to be accepted with equanimity. The seeker after wisdom was taught to be indifferent alike to pleasure or pain, and to maintain an intellectual neutrality. So, does this give you an idea what stoical unconcern is? There is a modern word for this today, which young people like to use.
Cool.
That's right, that's cool. You know, when you really are in the mid of strife and trouble and you show indifference, you are not touched by it, that's cool, isn't it? It's cool. That is stoicism. Indifferent alike to pleasure or pain, and maintain an intellectual neutrality. Now, an intellectual neutrality means you can discuss about every and anything. No wonder that the Stoics were quite willing to discuss with Paul about whatever he wanted. But at the same time, they looked down upon him because they, of course, had a very superior philosophy. That Paul was so passionate about these gods, they despised. That he would be zealous for his cause. Well, we are standing above this. You know, that is the whole idea. And what is this Stoicism really? It's a wall building. The reason why we study this here is we want to identify the walls that are built. And we need to ask ourselves, where do we have these things? Indifference is definitely a wall. Indifference, not to our needs, but to the needs of other people. Let us come now to the question what stoical really is. And there are a few points that I could write down. First of all, it is to be indifferent. Second, it is to be inviolable. What is inviolable? Untouchable. That's right, don't touch me. I'm standing above the whole thing. Don't ask me questions. You know, when a teacher says, well, you don't ask me questions, then he's inviolable. What else? It is to be self-righteous, definitely. I'm better than you. It is to be hypocritical. Because that is what the philosophy always led to. The people never could live up to their ideal. To be indifferent alike to pain and to pleasure. I mean, that is not human. And therefore, they would pretend to be indifferent alike to pain and pleasure, but in their heart they weren't. That means hypocrisy, isn't it? So that is what stoical is summed up with. Indifference, inviolable, self-righteous. Let's turn again to Desire of Ages and read this again. All manifested a stoical unconcern. Do you understand better now what this means? A stoical unconcern. So they were Stoics, in fact. Or Pharisees. Pharisees were Stoics. Seeming unconscious that there was anything for them to do. By their silence, they refused to humble themselves. Now the question is asked, of course, how was Christ to bring these poor souls where Satan would not gain over them a decided victory? How could he show them? A mere profession of discipleship did not make them disciples or ensure them a place in his kingdom. How could he show that it was loving service, true humility, which constitutes real greatness? How was he to kindle love in their hearts and enable them to comprehend what he longed to tell them? So Jesus was not stoical. Absolutely not. He did not necessarily jump out and cry out, or he did not weep visibly here, but in his heart he was deeply sorrowed. And he did not leave the situation like this, but addressed it. He stood up and washed the disciples' feet, as we know. So likewise, when the disciples loitered behind on the way through Galilee, again, Jesus did not leave the situation like this. He could not immediately deal with it. That's true. That was not possible. But at the same time, he did not just leave the situation and say, well, maybe it solves itself. He was diligently working to break down these walls of stoicism. And you know, once confessions are made, you wonder before how thick the walls were. That's just amazing. Once the walls are breaking down, you really are very, very grateful that they are breaking down. Now let us come back to the chapter Who is the Greatest in these Desaubetes, chapter 48. And I want to read just a little bit more there. While Jesus made it plain, that's here, page 434. When Christ and the disciples, it's the last paragraph on the page, when Christ and the disciples were alone in the house while Peter was gone to the sea, Jesus called the others to him and asked, "What was it that ye disputed among yourselves by the way?" The presence of Jesus and his question put the matter in an entirely different light from that in which it had appeared to them while they were contending by the way. Shame and self-condemnation kept them silent. Jesus had told them that he was to die for their sake, and their selfish ambition was in painful contrast to his unselfish love. It's interesting that his question put the matter into an entirely different light. It brought something out that was latent there already. Latent, they knew already that what they talked was wrong. Otherwise, they wouldn't have loitered behind. But now that Jesus would even ask them, it was like Achan. You know, he was now coming, the judgment was coming closer and closer to him. And that's like we have done something and we try to hide it, but step by step, the revelations come closer and closer to our sin. It's an unpleasant feeling, isn't it? Put the matter in an entirely different light from that in which it had appeared to them while contending. By the way, shame and self-condemnation kept them silent. Jesus told them that it was that he was to die for their sake, and their selfish ambition was in painful contrast to his unselfish love. When Jesus told them that he was to be put to death and to rise again, he was trying to draw them into conversation in regard to the great test of their faith. Had they been ready to receive what he desired to make known to them, they would have been saved bitter anguish and despair. His words would have brought consolation in the hour of bereavement and disappointment. But although he had spoken so plainly of what awaited him, his mention of the fact that he was soon to go to Jerusalem again kindled their hope that the kingdom was about to be set up. This had led to questioning as to who should fill the highest offices. On Peter's return from the sea, the disciples told him of the Savior's question, and at last one ventured to ask Jesus, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" I really like this word here, at last one ventured to ask Jesus. That is exactly what Jesus encouraged them. Bring out your question. Tell it. Say it to me. What is the matter? It's much better when you ask it than when you keep it for yourself. Even though what you did was not right, ask it. Tell me your other experiences as well. I want to be able to help you. The Savior gathered his disciples about him, it says. So he didn't send them away. He didn't say, "Oh, what question you have asked her again. You silly people." Or got very mad or something. No, he gathered his disciples about him. What does this speak of you, this simple sentence? That's right. He said, come, my friends, I tell you something now. Who is the greatest? Come, my friends, come near to me. And then they came very near to him. What is he telling us now? It's like daddy calling his children, you know. Come, I have to tell you something. And they come near, and he says, if any man desires to be first, the same shall be last and servant of all. And there was a solemnity and a love in these words that they could not misunderstand. They really realized that Jesus was helping them and not condemning them. There was in these words a solemnity and impressiveness which the disciples were far from comprehending. That which Christ discerned, they could not see. They did not understand the nature of Christ's kingdom. And this ignorance was the apparent cause for their contention. But the real cause lay deeper. By explaining the nature of the kingdom, Christ might, for the time, have quelled their strife, but this would not have touched the underlying cause. Even after they had received the fullest knowledge, any question of precedence might have renewed the trouble. Thus, disaster would have been brought to the church after Christ's departure. The strife for the highest place was the outworking of the same spirit which was the beginning of the great controversy, in the words above, and which had brought Christ from heaven to die. About this we have to study still more. Let us now go back a little bit and look at some of these words here. They did not understand the nature of Christ's kingdom. They did not understand. So where was the problem? In the understanding? She says that was the apparent cause. Apparent means the superficial cause. But there was a deeper cause. And what was the deeper cause under that understanding? It was the heart condition. You see, we have two problems to deal with in every step of Reformation. This is something we really need to understand clearly. We always have to deal with two things. That is understanding, number one, and a heart condition, number two. The problem is that often we are satisfied with a change of understanding. We do not see the need of a change of a heart condition. So therefore, as soon as we understood it, we say, now we got it. Wonderful, that's it. And that's for us is the end of the matter. And then we wonder why the same sin comes up again. We say, what happened now? The reason is that we did not see that the root was not just the understanding of the problem, it was in the heart. So for every step of the Reformation, for every sin that we overcome, there's not only a change of understanding that is necessary, but also a change of heart. And this you see very clearly here. Jesus recognized this, he realized this. He could give them any explanation about the nature of God's kingdom that he wanted to. Probably some things they would have understood, but it wouldn't have changed their heart. So how did he talk with them? He put a child in their midst, and he tried to explain from a child what their natures, their heart condition must be. In other words, he did not just give an explanation of the kingdom of God, he showed them their need of a heart change. Now this heart change they received only partially at that moment, because later they strove again about the question, who is the greatest? But another great victory was gained at the foot washing, as you know. After the foot washing, still their understanding was not quite right about the kingdom. However, their heart condition was better. Now they were ready to give to one another the highest place. You see, their understanding was not quite right. How do we know that their understanding was not quite right? Even after the foot washing. That's right, of what happened in the garden, and even after his resurrection. Because when Jesus ascended to heaven, what did they ask him? When will you set up your kingdom? I mean, that was sad, wasn't it? Even then they asked him, when will you set up your kingdom? They still hadn't overcome this old concept. Which shows that the mind is slow to learn. But what was their heart condition? Sister White says, after the foot washing, they were ready to give to one another the highest place. And this was more important to Jesus than the understanding that needed to be there. Of course, they got a partial better understanding too, But without the change of heart, every understanding is of no avail. So likewise, when we study these things here, and we study the breaking down of walls, it's quite fine if we understand it, but in order to do it, we need a change of heart. That's what we need to realize. So it's every step of the Reformation. The real cause lay deeper. By explaining the nature of the kingdom, Christ might for the time have quelled their strife, but this would not have touched the underlying cause. Even after they had received the fullest knowledge, any question of precedence might have renewed the trouble. Thus disaster would have been brought to the church after Christ's departure. The strife for the highest place was the outworking of that same spirit which was the beginning of the great controversy in the world above, and which had brought Christ from heaven to die. There rose up before him a vision of Lucifer, the son of the morning, in glory, surpassing all the angels that surrounded the throne, and united in closest ties to the Son of God. Lucifer had said, "I will be like the Most High," and the desire for self-exaltation had brought strife into the heavenly courts, and had banished a multitude of the hosts of God. Had Lucifer really desired to be like the Most High, he would never have deserted his appointed place in heaven. For the Spirit of the Most High is manifested in unselfish ministry. Lucifer desired God's power, but not his character. He sought for himself the highest place, and every being who is actuated by his spirit will do the same. Thus, alienation, discord, and strife will be inevitable. Dominion becomes the prize of the strongest. The kingdom of Satan is a kingdom of force. Every individual regards every other as an obstacle in the way of his own advancement, or a stepping stone in which he himself may climb to a higher place. Now, we have to come to Lucifer, and in our next study, look at his experience a little bit in order to understand how walls are built and how walls are broken down. So, do you have any question for this study so far? Yes, Miriam. Precisely. That is breaking down walls. Yes.
I had the vision of a council of bishops and cardinals, they all big priests and priests. You had to deal with this kind of character, even if they were born again. And if you would get angry, because when we see people doing mistakes, we tend to put another wall. Like you said, Jesus would have been indignant, He had to really know how to deal with it. In the family where the child is taken, become indignant. We say, you are infallible. Why are you mistaken now? Jesus, it takes so much.
The most delicate touch, the greatest skill. Moses was committed the highest work on earth, which required the most delicate touch and the greatest skill. Good. Shall we shall we take a break of 10 minutes? Is this sufficient? Till 10:20 past.